After a couple of weeks, we resume our reading of the 14th chapter, The Principle of Divine Works and Essays on the Gita, which, as it was serialized in the Arya, saw its first appearance on the 15th of September, 1917. We've been talking about the nature of collective yoga of late and how it is that we should act in the world. So I think perhaps we can recognize that the community of integral yogins represents a banding together of spiritual warriors, warriors of light who have come to dispel darkness. And so represent, in a sense, the best of what humanity might be. As we arc upwards to meet whatever light it wishes to descend from above, beyond the realm of the mind. So let's go back a few lines to the paragraph that concluded when last we met. Quote, "The best, the individuals who are in advance of the general line and above the general level of the collectivity, are the natural leaders of mankind. For it is they who can point to the race, both the way they must follow and the standard or ideal they have to keep to or to attain. But the divinized man is the best in no ordinary sense of the word, and his influence, his example, must have a power which that of no ordinarily superior man can exercise. What example then shall he give? What rule or standard shall he uphold?" Influence and example go far beyond mere instruction. You'll remember in the earliest essays that Sri Aurobindo composed in Synthesis of Yoga, he's declaring that all life is yoga. And the nature of the teacher is not simply the one who gives the word. The teacher must show an action, must become the model to fill out the standard, to make it dynamic. But more than that even, the teacher should have the power of influence, should in inner realms draw people like a magnet to the ideal, empower them with unsuspected energy, help them to evoke from within themselves the powers that lie lurking there, untapped resources that had never been seen, and bring them forward in life. Here and now, we need that. We need the people who are the most conscious to step forward and become bright citizens on the earth, showing how an integral yoga offers a model for humanity, marrying spirit and nature, not refusing the challenges of the world, but using the challenges as circumstances through which we rise to harmony and perfection in ourselves, but in all. So the Gita's plan is very much concordant with Sri Aurobindo's own view. So let's proceed now through the rest of the chapter. In order to indicate more perfectly his meaning, the divine teacher, the avatar, gives his own example, his own standard to Arjuna. "I abide in the path of action," he seems to say, "the path that all men follow, thou too must abide in action. In the way I act, in that way thou too must act. I am above the necessity of works, for I have nothing to gain by them. I am the divine who possess all things and all beings in the world. And I am myself beyond the world as well as in it, and I do not depend upon anything or anyone in all the three worlds for any object. Yet I act. You can go back to chapter 3, shloka 22, for the beginning of that. And here we see him take a rhetorical device in this paragraph that later in the second series will become almost standard practice. He is not so much translating the Gita as paraphrasing it, putting it into words that we can understand, flowing mellifluously through his pen or through his typewriter. This too must be thy manner and spirit of working. I, the divine, am the rule and the standard. It is I who make the path in which men tread. I am the way and the goal. But I do all this largely, universally, visibly in part, but far more invisibly. And men do not really know the way of my workings. Now, when thou knowest and seest, when thou hast become the divinized man, must be the individual power of God, the human yet divine example, even as I am in my avatars. Most men dwell in the ignorance. The God-seer dwells in the knowledge. But let him not confuse the minds of men by a dangerous example, rejecting in his superiority the works of the world. Let him not cut short the thread of action before it is spun out. Let him not perplex and falsify the stages and gradations of the ways I have hewn. This goes back to 3:26. The whole range of human action has been decreed by me with a view to the progress of man from the lower to the higher nature, from the apparent undivine to the conscious divine. The whole range of human works must be that in which the God-knower shall move. All individual, all social action, all the works of the intellect, the heart, and the body are still his, not any longer for his own separate sake, but for the sake of God in the world, of God in all beings, and that all those beings may move forward as he has moved by the path of works towards the discovery of the divine in themselves. Outwardly, his actions may not seem to differ essentially from theirs. Battle and rule, as well as teaching and thought, all the various commerce of man with man may fall in his range. But the spirit in which he does them must be very different. And it is that spirit which, by its influence, shall be the great attraction drawing men upwards to his own level, the great lever lifting the mass of men higher in their ascent. So it's a summary statement, and it yields to the next. The giving of the example of God himself to the liberated man is profoundly significant, for it reveals the whole basis of the Gita's philosophy of divine works. The liberated man is he who has exalted himself into the divine nature, and according to that divine nature must be his actions. Ah. Now we'll again look at the three Purushas. But what is the divine nature? It is not entirely and solely that of the Akshara, the immobile, inactive, impersonal self, for that by itself would lead the liberated man to actionless immobility. It is not characteristically that of the Kshara, the multitudinous, the personal, the Purusha, self-subjected to Prakriti, for that by itself would lead him back into subjection to his personality and to the lower nature and its qualities. It is the nature of the Purushottama who holds both these together and by his supreme divinity reconciles them in a divine reconciliation, which is the highest secret of his being. Rahasyam yetad uttamam. That's 4:3. He is not the doer of works in the personal sense of our action involved in Prakriti. For God works through his power, conscious nature, effective force, Shakti, Maya, Prakriti, but yet above it, not involved in it, not subject to it, not unable to lift himself beyond the laws, workings, habits of action it creates, not affected or bound by them, not unable to distinguish himself as we are unable from the workings of life, mind, and body. He is the doer of works who acts not. Kartaram akartaram. That's 4:13. So this Purushottama is not the stable, immobile, actionless Brahman, pure beyond time and space. It is not simply that sheer conscious self-existence. And it is not the personality trapped in the circumstances of the moment, with a name, with a form, identified wholly with that, with all the sensory apparatus. That is the Kshara Purusha. The Akshara gives us freedom from the Kshara, but the Gita is insisting that the divine worker must proceed beyond both of these by attaining union with the Purushottama, who supports both the Kshara and the Akshara, dwells in them both, and yet exceeds them. Know me, says Krishna, for the doer of this, the fourfold law of human workings, who am yet the imperishable non-doer. Works fix not themselves on me, nalimpanti, nor have I desire for the fruits of action. And this is generally 4:13, 4:14. Actions do not taste, na limpanti. But neither is he the inactive, impassive, unpuissant witness and nothing else. Unpuissant means powerless. Unpuissant witness and nothing else. For it is he who works in the steps and measures of his power, every movement of it, every particle of the world of beings it forms is instinct with his presence, full of his consciousness, impelled by his will, shaped by his knowledge. So there's nothing here which is not dripping with the divinity of the Purushottama, but the Purushottama is not identified with the mere workings of the formal aspects of Prakriti. We tend to get there through ego, but Purushottama is always beyond, even as he upholds these beings. He is besides the supreme without qualities, who is possessed of all qualities, nirguna guni. This is 13:14. nirgunam guna bhoktar. He is not bound by any mode of nature or action, nor consists, as our personality consists, of a sum of qualities, modes of nature, characteristic operations of the mental, moral, emotional, vital, physical being, but is the source of all modes and qualities, capable of developing any he wills in whatever way and to whatever degree he wills. He is the infinite being, of which they are ways of becoming, the immeasurable quantity and unbound ineffable, of which they are measures, numbers, and figures, which they seem to rhythmize and arrhythmize in the standards of the universe. Isn't that a beautiful usage of that word, arrhythmize? To remove the rhythms. Yet, neither is he merely an impersonal indeterminate, nor a mere stuff of conscious existence for all determinations and personalizings to draw upon for their material, but a supreme being, the one original conscious existent, the perfect personality, capable of all relations, even to the most human, concrete, and intimate. For he is friend, comrade, lover, playmate, guide, teacher, master, ministrant of knowledge, or ministrant of joy. Yet, in all relations, unbound, free, and absolute. So we see this divine being, who is free from any definition, pouring himself into every definition, every limit, every possible experience in a wide, wide universe, this divine inhabits, supports, in fact, wills to come into being. He, being itself, puts forth all these becomings, sarva bhutani. This too, the divinized man becomes in the measure of his attainment, impersonal in his personality, unbound by quality or action, even when maintaining the most personal and intimate relations with men, unbound by any dharma, even when following in appearance this or that dharma. Neither the dynamism of the kinetic man nor the actionless light of the ascetic or quietist, neither the vehement personality of the man of action, nor the indifferent impersonality of the philosophic sage is the complete divine ideal. These are the two conflicting standards of the man of this world and the ascetic or the quietist philosopher, one immersed in the action of the kshara, the other striving to dwell entirely in the peace of the akshara. But the complete divine ideal proceeds from the nature of the Purushottama, which transcends this conflict and reconciles all divine possibilities. And look who's doing the talking. It's Krishna speaking this to Arjuna. Krishna is this Purushottama, active in a human body, capable of dwelling at a point in the universe, a brilliant point, no doubt, effulgent, powerful. But at the same moment is the vast beyond. At the same moment is supporting all creatures, all beings in the universe, and yet is not confused by this triple status of personhood. Always exceeding, always the conscious base of all existence and that which transcends it, and always intimately involved in every movement, every thread of vibration in the cosmos. And all of it has been plucked like a lyre by the divine, who is the lyrist. The kinetic man, Wait. I think I missed a sentence. These are the two conflicting standards of the man of this world. No, I read that, didn't I? Pardon me. The kinetic man is not satisfied with any ideal which does not depend upon the fulfillment of this cosmic nature, this play of the three qualities of that nature, this human activity of mind and heart and body. The highest fulfillment of that activity, he might say, is my idea of human perfection, of the divine possibility in man, some ideal that satisfies the intellect, the heart, the moral being, some ideal of our human nature in its action can alone satisfy the human being. He must have something that he can seek in the workings of his mind and life and body, for that is his nature, his dharma. And how can he be fulfilled in something outside his nature? For to his nature, each being is bound, and within it, he must seek for his perfection. According to our human nature, must be our human perfection. And each man must strive for it according to the line of his personality, his swadharma. But in life and action, not outside life and action. Remember, this has been the whole argument that Krishna has been making to Arjuna. You are the kshatriya. It is your nature, your mission, which you accepted to come and protect the peoples, the world. And now, at this hour, you cannot abandon it. You can try to quit it and run away, but you can't. It's not your nature to run. So overcome this momentary weakness, pick up your bow, and go fight. He says it again and again throughout the Gita. So the kinetic man is Arjuna to some extent. It's only part of his nature, though. And he has to learn to accept his own nature, his swadharma, as true for him. And through his own nature, he can rise to the perfect. So we move through imperfection towards perfection. Yes, there is a truth in that, replies the Gita. The fulfillment of God in man, the play of the divine in life, is part of the ideal perfection. But if you seek it only in the external, in life, in the principle of action, you will never find it. You will then not only act according to your nature, which is in itself a rule of perfection, but you will be, and this is a rule of the imperfection, eternally subject to its modes, its dualities of liking and dislike, pain and pleasure, and especially to the rajasic mode with its principle of desire and its snare of wrath and grief and longing, the restless, all-devouring principle of desire, the insatiable fire which besieges your worldly action, the eternal enemy of knowledge by which it is covered over here in your nature, as is a fire by smoke or a mirror by dust, and which you must slay in order to live in the calm, clear, luminous truth of the Spirit. So this is pretty closely translated from 3:37 to 40. The senses, mind, and intellect are the seat of this eternal cause of imperfection. And yet, it is within this sense, mind, and intellect, this play of the lower nature, that you would limit your search for perfection. The effort is vain. The kinetic side of your nature must first seek to add to itself the quietistic. You must uplift yourself beyond this lower nature to that which is above the three gunas, that which is founded in the highest principle, in the soul. Only when you have attained to peace of soul can you become capable of a free and divine action. So, yes, indeed, Krishna instructs Arjuna to rise beyond, to as we would say in later ages, attain to moksha, to get the liberation from ego, from desire, to saturate your being with the essential being of sat. And in that conscious existence, liberate yourself from thraldom to the senses, from the engine of wrath and desire. Then you can return. Once free, you're not done. You don't just sit up there on the peak of that mountain. You come back into the world. Krishna will express why and how. The quietist, the ascetic, on the other hand, cannot see any possibility of perfection into which life and action enter. So here's the other side of it. So the kinetic man wants this action, and the ascetic wants to be free of action. What do we do? Are they not the very seat of bondage and imperfection? Is not all action imperfect in its nature, like a fire that must produce smoke? Is not the principle of action itself rajasic, the father of desire, a cause that must have its effective obscuration of knowledge, its round of longing and success and failure, its oscillations of joy and grief, its duality, virtue and sin? God may be in the world, but he is not of the world. He is a god of renunciation, and not the master or cause of our works. The master of our works is desire, and the cause of works is ignorance. Sounds very close to Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta, doesn't it? If the world, the kshara, is in a sense a manifestation or a lila, a play of the divine, it is an imperfect play with the ignorance of nature, an obscuration rather than a manifestation, that which is imposed on it. Yes. That is surely evident from our very first glance at the nature of the world. And does not the fullest experience of the world teach us always the same truth? Is it not a wheel of the ignorance, binding the soul to continual birth by the impulsion of desire and action until at last that is exhausted or cast away? Ah, the wheel of samsara, Buddhism at its finest. Not only desire, but action also must be flung away. Seated in the silent self, the soul will then pass away into the motionless, actionless, imperturbable, absolute Brahman. To the objection of the impersonalizing quietist, the Gita is at more pains to answer than to that of the man of the world, the kinetic individual, for this quietism, having hold of a higher and more powerful truth, which is yet not the whole of the highest truth, its promulgation as the universal, complete, highest ideal of human life is likely to be more confusing and disastrous to the advance of the human race towards its goal than the error of an exclusive kinetism. And you'll find Sri Aurobindo fleshing out this argument when he turns to the realm of politics and history, etc., saying that when this gospel of the vanity of life has ever taken root in some nation or the other, it has led it to lose its dynamism, as it had some impact in that way in the life of India, which in its ancient days, in the days of the Veda and the Upanishads, was the most powerful and wealthy country upon earth. And then after the visitation of Jainism, Buddhism, Shankara's Advaita, and the arrival of Islam, lost its power of life and now is recovering it. inevitably it must recover it, because India is destined to be an exemplar in nationhood of what Krishna is exhorting Arjuna to do as an individual, to be dynamic and yet spiritual, to govern all well, to be in balance with all forces, to be kind, to be considerate, but to be real in the life of the spirit. India aspires to that and has just celebrated a birthday. If I've read this sentence, forgive me for reading it again. A strong, one-sided truth, when set forth as the whole truth, creates a strong light, but also a strong confusion. For the very strength of its element of truth increases the strength of its element of error. The error of the kinetic ideal can only prolong the ignorance and retard the human advance by setting it in search of perfection where perfection cannot be found. But the error of the quietistic ideal contains in itself the very principle of world destruction. And this will be 3:23 and 4. Were I to act upon it, says Krishna, I should destroy the peoples and be the author of confusion. And though the error of an individual human being, even though a nearly divine man, cannot destroy the whole race, it may produce a widespread confusion, which may be in its nature destructive of the principle of human life and disturbing to the settled line of its advance. Therefore, the quietistic tendency in man must be got to recognize its own incompleteness and admit on an equality with itself the truth which lies behind the kinetic tendency, the fulfillment of God in man and the presence of the divine in all the action of the human race. If it's invested even secretly with divinity, we must respect it. We must value it. We can't simply push it away as some vanity. We have to use human life and humanity as the scene of a cosmic play in which forces, nether and divine, are trying to evoke through their twin action a descent of a yet higher truth, which alone can restore whole value. But we can't get there. We can't invoke that moment of transformation unless we recognize that our work in the world is valuable. God is there, not only in the silence, but in the action. The quietism of the impassive soul, unaffected by nature, and the kinetism of the soul giving itself to nature, so that the great world sacrifice, the Purusha Yajna, may be affected, are not a reality and a falsehood in perpetual struggle, nor yet two hostile realities, one superior, the other inferior, each fatal to the other. They are the double term of the divine manifestation. The Akshara alone is not the whole key of their fulfillment, not the very highest secret. The double fulfillment, the reconciliation, is to be sought in the Purushottama, represented here by Krishna, at once Supreme Being, Lord of the Worlds, and Avatar. The divinized man, entering into his divine nature, will act even as he acts. He will not give himself up to inaction. In other words, one takes on the nature of the Purushottama. One becomes coincident with that greater being. The divine is at work in man, in the ignorance, and at work in man, in the knowledge. To know him is our soul's highest welfare and the condition of its perfection. But to know and realize him as a transcendent peace and silence is not all. The secret that has to be learned is at once the secret of the eternal and unborn divine and the secret of the divine birth and works. Janma karma cha me divyam. That's 4:9. The action which proceeds from that knowledge will be free from all bondage. He who so knoweth me, says the teacher, is not bound by works. That's 4:14. So, Gnostic action is free of karmic debt. If you live in the divine conscious being, then it is the divine who acts, and there is no attachment, there is no lesson that must come back to you, there is no fruit that belongs to you, seemingly or otherwise. It belongs to nature. It belongs to the divine who receives the gift of nature. So knowledge leads to freedom. If the escape from the obligation of works and desire and from the wheel of rebirth is to be the aim and the ideal, then this knowledge is to be taken as the true, the broad way of escape. For, says the Gita, he who knows in their right principles my divine birth and works comes when he leaves his body not to rebirth, but to me, O Arjuna. That's 4:9. Mam eti saha. Through the knowledge and possession of the divine birth, he comes to the unborn and imperishable divine, who is the self of all beings, ajo avyaya atma. Through the knowledge and execution of divine works to the master of works, the Lord of all beings, Bhutanam Ishvara. So that's 4:6 and later 18:61. And it reads in English, though I am unborn, imperishable, and the Lord of beings, yet I stand upon my own nature and come into birth by my self Maya. He lives in that unborn being. His works are those of that universal mastery. So next week, we start the 15th chapter. We finish our evening with a section from Savitri. This is in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, in Canto 2, the Kingdom of Subtle Matter. We'll start on page 111. About halfway down the page. Thence comes the mystic substance of our souls into the prodigy of our nature's birth. There is the unfallen height of all we are and dateless fount of all we hope to be. On every plane, the hieratic power, initiate of unspoken verities, dreams to transcribe and make a part of life in its own native style and living tongue, some trait of the perfection of the unborn, some vision seen in the omniscient light, some far tone of the immortal rhapsodist voice, some rapture of the all-creating bliss, some form and plan of the beauty unutterable. Worlds are there, nearer to those absolute realms, where the response to truth is swift and sure, and spirit is not hampered by its frame, and hearts by sharp division seized and rent, and delight and beauty are inhabitants, and love and sweetness are the law of life. A finer substance and a subtler mold embodies the divinity earth but dreams. Its strength can overtake joy's running feet, overleaping the fixed hurdles set by time. The rapid net of an intuitive clasp captures the fugitive happiness we desire. A nature lifted by a larger breath, plastic and passive to the all-shaping fire, answers the flaming Godhead's casual touch. Immune from our inertia of response, it hears the word to which our hearts are deaf, adopts the seeing of immortal eyes, and, traveler on the roads of line and hue, pursues the spirit of beauty to its home. Thus we draw near to the all-wonderful, following his rapture in things as sign and guide. Beauty is his footprint, showing us where he has passed. Love is his heartbeat's rhythm in mortal breasts, happiness the smile on his adorable face. A communion of spiritual entities, a genius of creative immanence, makes all creation deeply intimate. A fourth dimension of aesthetic sense, where all is in ourselves and all, to the cosmic wideness realigns our souls. A kindling rapture joins the seer and seen. The craftsman and the craft grown inly one achieve perfection by the magic throb and passion of their close identity. All that we slowly piece from gathered parts, or by long labor stumblingly evolve, is there self-born by its eternal right. In us too, the intuitive fire can burn, an agent light. It is coiled in our folded hearts. On the celestial levels is its home. Descending, it can bring those heavens here. But rarely burns the flame, nor burns for long. The joy it calls from those diviner heights brings brief, magnificent reminiscences and high, splendid glimpses of interpreting thought, but not the utter vision and delight. A veil is kept, something is still held back, lest, captives of the beauty and the joy, our souls forget to the highest to aspire. So thank you. Namaste.